For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. He does not make money off the site, but he does need money in order to run the site. Those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site. Okay, welcome. Excited to see all of you, those of our regular Monday night attendees and those who have come to join us for tonight's special class. Tonight, as I'm sure most of you are familiar, is Yom HaAtzma'ut. We're crossing a threshold as we speak. Today, Monday, was actually the 5th of Iyar, the day on the calendar where the modern state of Israel was reborn. It was born again, so to speak. They're returning home after 2,000 years of exile is a tremendous milestone in Jewish history, in our lifetimes, to have seen and lived through something like that. And that was celebrated, took place today, Monday. Because of various reasons, the Israeli government and Rabbanut are actually going to be celebrating it starting tonight in Israel and tomorrow. And today was memorialized as Yom HaZikaron for the soldiers who have fallen in allowing these miraculous events to take place. And on this occasion of recognizing the miraculous events which took place today, tomorrow, and are continuously celebrated throughout the Jewish world, so tonight's class is going to be related to that, specifically on the topic of Mashiach, on the coming of the Messiah, which is a fundamental element of our belief, and how that's going to play itself out in the future. I can't tell you, I am not a prophet. I do not know that. But how we can look back over the last 65 years and sort of put some of the things that have taken place into perspective, together with the sources which we have, some statements from our sages, in terms of painting the picture as to what things will look like, that's the goal of tonight. To me it sounds like I'm very loud. Am I? Okay. So when I start screaming, then I'll get loud. But right now, this is okay. All right, so let me start with what I am not going to do. Tonight, what I am not going to do, contrary to a number of people who I heard murmuring about this as I was been walking around, I am not going to tell you when Mashiach is going to come. None of you paid for this course tonight, so there's no way you're going to find out that information for free. That's for sure. And I happen to not know or have any clue when that's going to happen. The Ramban and Nachmanides writes that there are preordained times that are auspicious for Mashiach to come. Not necessarily one time. We will speak a lot more about this as we go on, but there are certain times in history that are auspicious, that are potential times for the Mashiach to come. The Ramban has a lot to say about. He wrote a book that covers a lot of areas regarding that. But nonetheless, the Gemara says that so your source sheets, I put together a lot of things. Don't be overwhelmed by them. We're not going to go through all of them inside, but I wanted you to have some of the things that we're going to be discussing. So even if I quote it quickly, you'll at least have it in front of you and you can look at it at your own leisure. So despite the fact that the Ramban says there are specific times, it is already well established within our tradition not to try to figure those things out. The Gemara in Sanhedrin specifically says at source number one on your sheet that the very essence of the people who try to calculate the end, they should suffer agony. The Gemara is a strong language that it should be a painful experience for anybody. It's like almost a curse upon he who tries to calculate the end. And the Gemara says, because what's going to happen is if you start putting dates on the calendar, and those dates inevitably come and then go, so then all the other people who were looking forward to that date and watched it pass right by will then begin to think, well, if this was actually supposed to be the date and he didn't come, then maybe he's never going to come. And it's just going to be a big downer for everybody. The Gemara has very negative statements about specifically doing that. The Gemara says, is a phrase that you're all familiar with, the Gemara says, but what our job as Jews is to wait for him, as the Pasuk in Habakkuk says, one of the Nevi'im, if he tarries, your job is simply to wait for him. So I'm not going to be discussing in any way when he's going to become. We're not going to be working with any calculations. There have been numerous sages throughout the generations who have indeed given us specific times when it might be, when it might be auspicious. They have obviously not come, and I am not going to be addressing that. The Rambam, Maimonides, will be quoting often, writes that the sages themselves did not know, the prophets didn't have a clear indication, and they left things specifically ambiguous. There are many statements in the Talmud, and when you put them all together, you're left with anything but clarity as to what the issue with Mashiach is. The Gemara makes numerous statements that the generation in which Mashiach will come will be only either all wicked or will be all righteous. It makes numerous statements like that, some of which make sense to us, some of which don't make sense to us. You put them all together, it's very ambiguous. The Rambam writes, it's on purpose that way. Because the sages themselves didn't have anything clear. They didn't want us to have a specific thing. They wanted it to be part of our consciousness to yearn, wait for it, as we'll see. But we're not going to have anything specific. Our people, as Jews, we're very weary when anybody mentions the word Mashiach. We have had numerous negative experiences with people claiming to be the Messiah. It starts in the times of the Talmud with Bar Kokhba. Rabbi Akiva himself, the great sage, believed that Bar Kokhba was going to be the Messiah. Maybe indeed he had the potential to. That I can't tell you, but it ended in disaster for the Jewish people. There's a certain Jew who became, whether through him or through others, a founder of a very popular religion, which of course has not been good for the Jews over the centuries. Much bloodshed from our Christian friends, and that also started from a claim to be the Messiah. And then even in more recent history, with Shabtai Tzvi in the 1600s, which was a tremendous debacle for the Jewish people. Those who've been here on Monday nights know that we've been discussing the 1500s and 1600s coming out of the medieval period, which was just a bloodbath for the Jews. The ground was fertile and ripe for messianic fervor. The Hasidic movement grew up in the 1700s. The Kabbalistic movement took hold in the 1600s. It was a time that was ripe. People were talking messianic in terms of the desire to go back. And in the 1600s, we had the Shabtai Tzvi debacle. In the 1700s, it was followed by a man named Jacob Frank, who also claimed to be who took over for Shabtai Tzvi and continued in his path. And both of them were terrible times. Successor, thank you, for the Jewish people. And even in more modern times, more recently, within the world of Chabad, after the passing of the Rebbe, there was a group of people who claimed that the Rebbe was the Messiah, and the Jewish world has just recoiled from that. It's just been one negative experience after another when somebody claims to be the Messiah, to be Mashiach. It hasn't worked out well for us historically, and as Jews, we're therefore just we have a knee-jerk reaction. And as much as we're yearning for it, and as soon as someone says, I'm it, we reject him and we push him aside. That's sort of how history has trained us to be, despite the fact that we continue to yearn and want for him to come, but we don't want anything to do with it. So what I'm not doing tonight is anything to do with that. We're not going to be discussing when he's going to come. I'm not going to tell you who he's going to be, what he's going to look like. That we're not going to be discussing. What are we going to be discussing? Since we can't look into the future, we will look a little bit into the past. I'd like to take a look at the last 65, 70 years, taking a look at it through the prism of the sages who had no idea, well, I shouldn't say that, who lived way before the past 70 years have actually unfolded, and to see statements that they made 1,000, 1,500 years ago are in a way playing themselves out before our eyes, so that while I will not be making any predictions, but it's just important for us to realize the times that we live in. Let me give you a little introduction. Let's take a step back at the times we live in. Imagine any one of our great-grandparents or grandparents, whatever it may be, living, let's say, the turn of the century in the 1900s, early 1900s, 1910, 1920, in some small shtetl in Europe. And you were to tell them the following facts. In the next 20 years, there's going to be a Holocaust that is unimaginable. Despite everything that's happened in history, despite the Crusades, despite the Inquisition, despite the pogroms, despite it all, unimaginable. 6 million of our people are going to be slaughtered. 6 million out of 14, 15, 16 million Jews worldwide. We're going to knock out a third of our people. It's going to be a disaster. Europe is going to be in ruins. And the generation that's going to make it out of Europe are going to be orphaned. And the generation that survived in America, European Jewry thought that the American scene was a literal spiritual wasteland. The Chazon Ish would not even speak to somebody who was planning on moving to America because it meant total spiritual death. Chofetz Chaim wrote a book specifically for Jews going to America, how to try to maintain, how to work on Shabbos, because of course you're going to be working on Shabbos. How could you do the least bit of violation of Shabbos? It was just the European community viewed America, and that's what's left. So you were to say to such a Jew in 1900, we're going to lose 6 million, they're going to be slaughtered. Those that are left are going to come out of that destruction, and they're going to have their American cousins to rebuild Judaism in the spiritual wasteland that is America. And 50 years after that, there are going to be over 6 million Jews living in Israel.
There's going to be a Jewish government running the state. The language of Hebrew will be completely rebuilt and will become a language. That state of Israel will have its own currency. They'll have its own stock market. They'll have its own businesses. They'll be world-renowned in the elements of economics, in technology. They will be a thriving economy. Agriculture will be bursting through the land. Torah will be centered in the land of Israel in a way that it has not been since the destruction of the temple, during which time there were less than 6 million Jews living in the land of Israel. So we'll now have the 6 million there. We will have all of these elements, and any Jew in the world can travel there whenever he or she wants and can live there, something which has also not taken place in the Second Temple. And you were to speak to a 1900s Jew in Europe, and you were to describe those two factors which would happen in the next 100 years. The destruction of the 6 million, and then the rebirth of the state of Israel that's controlled by Jews, run by Jews, with such an economy, with such an agriculture, with over 6 million Jews living in it, and freedom for anybody to go. And their response would be one thing and one thing only.
Two things.
They would either say, "You're crazy," or they would say, "Mashiach has come." And they would be right. Because if it wasn't one of those, that's the only option. Either you're nuts, or Mashiach has come. Because what has happened is absolutely impossible. It's insane. We live it, so we forget to stop and think about it. It's 100 years ago. If you were to describe to a Jew 100 years ago what we are living through today, they would say you're either certifiable, or Mashiach has come. That's what they would say. What are the other options? How did this happen? We have a country of 6 million Jews. It's our own government, our own currency, our own stock market, our own agriculture. We're world leaders in technology in so many different ways. Mashiach came. They'd be thinking there, and anyone can go? Any Jew can just get on a flight for a couple hundred bucks and move there? A couple hundred, whatever. Yeah, I'm so pessimistic. I'm trying to get you out of here. Whatever. Anyone can go? Anyone? No restrictions? No quotas? Immediate citizenship? Protection by one of the greatest armies in the world? Mashiach is here. Mashiach is here. What other response would you have? And we know everything I said is true, and Mashiach is not here. What a fascinating time we live in. It is not. Because that same country is not a Shomer Shabbos country. It's not observant of all of the laws. It's sometimes anti-religious. We have problems, and we still have 8 million Jews living outside of the land of Israel. So we are living in this fascinating time in which any objective observer 100 years ago would say, Mashiach, he's come. And we know indeed he hasn't. And by definition, the fact that you're sitting in this room, you, like me, are not picking up and moving. Maybe some of you in the crowd have plans, as I know that some of you do, some more immediate than others. But we're all here. We're all here, and we've had 65 years to get out of here. And yet we're still here. And the reason why we're still here is because you and I say every day, when Mashiach comes, we're going to Eretz Yisrael. And He has not come. So this is the aspect that I'd like to talk about tonight. This concept, what is going on today, and how do we view the events as far as they are. So let's begin a little bit. This concept of waiting for Mashiach is a fundamental concept in all of Judaism. If you look on your sheet, the Rambam codifies it in his 13 principles of faith. It's his 12th of his 13 principles. I believe with complete faith in the coming of the Messiah. I believe Mashiach is coming. No matter how long it takes, I will await His coming day. Says the Rambam, the principle of faith to await His coming, we sing it in Yigdal, the end of Shabbos. He will send our Messiah at the end of days to redeem those who await His final salvation. We await God's salvation. It's been a 2,000 year exile. We await it, and we wait for the Mashiach to bring us. And the Rambam in the next
source says that anyone who does not believe in Him or does not await His coming denies not only the statements of the other prophets, but those of the Torah and of Moshe. Because the Torah says He's coming. The Torah tells us there's going to be an exile, and then God is going to come and redeem us and take us out. As the pasuk says, He will bring you back from your captivity and have mercy upon you, gathering you from amongst the nations. And even if you're diasporas at the end of the heavens, God will gather you up from there and bring you to the land. Says the Rambam, that is our fundamental tenet of our belief, that no matter where we end up in this exile, there will be a Mashiach who is going to come. He's going to come, He's going to redeem us, and He's going to bring us back to the land, as indeed the Pasuk says. Now, this is such a fundamental concept that the Gemara records that when we die, we are going to stand in front of the heavenly court. Our soul will be judged in front of the heavenly court, and they're going to ask us a couple of questions. Just a few questions the heavenly court is going to ask of us to know, so how'd you do? So you had your 120 years. How were things? And the way the Gemara says that's going to look is in six specific questions. That's important for us to know, because since we want to know the kinds of, we don't want to be blindsided when we get up to heaven after 120 years and think, oh, I didn't realize that was so important. If somebody would have told me, I might have done that better. So it's important to know, what are the big six? What are the questions that God will ask us? It's on the bottom of your sheet on page one. They're going to ask whether or not you were dealt in with good faith with others. Were you honest in your business dealings? They're going to ask if you set aside fixed times for Torah study. On Monday night, 7:45, where were you? That's what they're going to ask. They're going to ask that question. Where were you? Because there were classes designated for you every night. Did you have fixed times for Torah study? That's question number two, the Gemara says that they're going to ask. They're going to ask whether or not you attempted to fulfill the mitzvah of Peru or Vu, of having children and populating the world. And then they're going to ask you, did you yearn for the redemption? Each and every one of us is going to be asked. The fourth question that we're going to be asked when we get up to heaven, after 120 years, did you or did you not yearn for redemption? You were living in Atlanta, Georgia. You were living wherever in the world you found yourself. Did you yearn to get out of it? Did you yearn every day to say, to yearn, the Rambam writes, like looking outside the window, you're waiting for somebody to come to pick you up to go somewhere, and you can't wait. You got your head out the window. You're constantly checking. Not that it makes it going to come any faster, but you can't keep your eyes off the window to know when is it happening. Did you do that? That's what they're going to ask us. Were you looking out the window? Because God says, I wasn't home, and you weren't home, and you spent a lifetime away from me. Did you care? Did you want it? Did you yearn for it? See, peacefully Yeshua, did you yearn and look forward for the redemption? That's part, not just a fundamental tenet of our belief, as the Rambam says, that I believe in the Mashiach. It's not just that I believe He exists and that He'll come, but that I yearn for it. I await it. I can't wait for it to come. The Medrash, in fact, says that it's, I have it here, number six, that if the Jewish people have no merit other than their yearning for the redemption, they'll be worthy of being redeemed for that alone. We might not have anything else going for us, and we're going to be talking about the different types of redemptions, but if we have nothing other than the fact that every Jew, when they finish in this world after 120 years, can say, I yearned for it. I waited for it. I wanted it. I wanted to go home. I wanted to see your presence revealed throughout the world. I was not satisfied with life in exile. I was not happy with there being other gods recognized as true gods. I want something different. I want the truth to come out. If every Jew can say that, that alone would bring the redemption. Just the fact that every Jew wanted that, we might not have anything else going for us, that would earn and merit the redemption, says the Medrash, just from that alone. Okay, so this is all, most of the stuff I'm sure you all know. I have, because of this, concluded dozens and dozens of classes in the manner in which you have yourselves heard dozens and dozens of classes concluded with, and this is how you know when the class is over, when the speaker says, and Mashiach should come and bring us back to Yerushalayim. Amen. That's the official end line of the class. I don't know how to end the shiur. The way you ended it is by saying, and Mashiach should come and redeem us.
Yeah, amen. So that's how we end. Right? What does that say? Because this is what we're waiting for Mashiach. I'm doing what I'm supposed to. I believe in Him. I'm awaiting Him eagerly. And when He comes and takes me home, we'll go home. So that sentiment of I'm waiting for Him to come, Mashiach should come b'mehera v'yameinu and bring us back. That has been, I have said that dozens of times. I'm sure you've heard that dozens of times. So this class was born out of an experience that I had last year when we completed the Tanakh. The Tanakh class. We were on our way to Eretz Yisrael. Now, I came across the following thing which I'm going to share with you. Now, the reality is, much as I have said that Mashiach should come and bring us back to Eretz Yisrael, b'mehera v'yameinu, amen, the reality is 6 million Jews seem to have done it all by themselves. Right, I'm sitting here waiting and waiting and waiting, and at the end of the day, I got a lot of cousins, brothers, sisters, they're not waiting, they went. 6 million of them. We're only 8 million left back here. We're still standing here saying, Mashiach should come and take us back. Meanwhile, we got a pretty significant number who picked up and left without Mashiach. So when this was brought home to me, was on a plane ride to Eretz Yisrael. So I have a group of 13 of us went to Eretz Yisrael last year at the end of our course of Tanakh, and we were going to have a Tanakh tour of the land. So while I'm on the plane, I had brought Arya Kaplan. He has a series of books. One of them is called Jerusalem. All of his books are these little pamphlets, 50, 60 pages each. Quick reading, fascinating, brilliant writer, brilliant insights. So he had a book on Jerusalem, so I figured we're doing a Tanakh tour. I would read up a little bit so I would sound intelligent to the people coming with me on the trip, and I would have these wise things to say. So I'm reading this book on the plane, on the way to Arizona. I come across the following paragraph, which I brought for you in source number 7. I'm going to read it to you, and you will be struck by the same thing I imagine that I was. There is a tradition, says Rabbi Kaplan, that the ingathering of the exile and the rebuilding of Jerusalem will go hand in hand as the two most important preludes to the coming of the Messiah. Now, I gave you a hint because I underlined it for you, but I read that. Wait, what? Hold on 1 second. I'm living in Atlanta. What am I doing in Atlanta? I'm waiting for Mashiach to come and take me home. That's what I'm doing here. Why did I go there too? What do you mean, why didn't I go? I'm waiting for Mashiach. That's how I conclude all my classes. When Mashiach comes, he'll take me home. I'm waiting. So I'm reading on the plane. I'm on my way to Israel. We've just spent a year learning Tanakh, which, those of you who participated last year, Tanakh can be summarized in the following sentence. You do bad, you're going to be kicked out of the land. Do good, you come home. That's all of Tanakh. So we're hammering this idea home. We're going to go back home. We're going to go back to the land. I'm on the plane. I'm going home. And I read, there's a tradition that when we come home and rebuild Yerushalayim, that will what? That will allow Mashiach to come. According to this tradition, says Rabbi Kaplan, first a small percentage of the exile will return to the Holy Land, and then Jerusalem will come under Jewish control and be rebuilt. Only then will the majority of Jews in the world return to their homeland. As it is written, Pasuk in Tehillim, God is rebuilding Jerusalem, He will gather the dispersed of Israel. First He rebuilds Jerusalem. With whom? With the Jews who came home. Jews come home, they rebuild Yerushalayim, and then Mashiach comes. Now, I had a very tough plane ride. What's this? It's not like I was 20 years old in yeshiva. I've been saying Mashiach is coming for a long time already. And now, as I'm going there, I come across what to me was for the first time, black and white, Rabbi Arya Kaplan is saying, the tradition, there is a tradition that's, and again, here, right, there is a tradition because as I started with, we don't really have any idea exactly how things are going to go, but there is a tradition that says, first we need to get all the Jews back home, or at least a good percentage of them, then we rebuild the country, rebuild Yerushalayim, so that Mashiach can come. I'm going to have this all wrong. Why am I sitting here waiting? I should go and be a part of the building. So now, where did he get this from? So he has footnotes. Because he's probably thinking there are going to be people like me who are going to read that and say, what are you talking about? I thought we were waiting for Mashiach. He continues, let's just read the next paragraph. This is his following a paragraph or two later in his book. Now, I gave you the pages at 75 and 76. That's not actually accurate. That's in the R.E. Kaplan Reader, where I took this from. If you have the little pamphlets on Jerusalem, I don't know what page it's on. It's in chapter 8. But if you have the Reader, which has like a bunch of those little pamphlets put together, it's on page 75, 76. He writes, and there's an important reason why the ingathering of the exile must precede the coming of Mashiach. Because there's a tradition that before Mashiach comes, prophecy will once again flourish among the Jewish people. Who's going to introduce Mashiach? Eliyahu HaNavi, Elijah the prophet, is supposedly coming to introduce. He's a prophet. Well, in order to have prophecy has a number of requirements. Number one, with only one exception, has prophecy taken place outside the land of Israel. That's with the prophet Yechezkel HaNavi, Ezekiel. Everyone else is in the land of Israel, and you need to have a majority of the Jews in the land for there to be the sanctity for prophecy to rest upon a human being. So in order for Elijah the prophet to come and introduce to the world that Mashiach is coming, who himself is supposed to be a prophet according to the Rambam, there needs to be the Jewish presence in the land of Israel at a majority to create the environment in which prophecy can return, in which point all of the processes of Mashiach can be brought back with Eliyahu, with Mashiach, establishing him as a king. In order to establish him as a king, he needs to be anointed. He needs to be anointed by a prophet. All of those things require that the Jews are already there before Mashiach comes. Now, that's a tradition. I read this on the plane, and I couldn't. Where? I never heard of this. This is all new. Now, it's always been in writing, I just never either paid attention to it or never seen it. But this got me thinking, which is resulting in the class tonight, as to, well, what's the deal? What are some of these things? We're watching miraculous times. We're living through them. We now have 6 million Jews living. You know, if I were living in 1900 and you would have told me that the Jews come back first and then Mashiach, all right, I don't know. This way, that way, it's all ridiculous. There were a small handful of Jews living in the land of Israel in 1900. You go back certainly to the 1800s, which is before even the earliest Zionist movement even was a dream on anybody's mindset. All right, academic issue, this, that way, the other, I don't know. But I'm reading this, last year in 2012, I got over 5 million Jews living in Israel. And all of a sudden finding out, wait a minute, this is deep into the process. The Jews are going to come back, they're going to be rebuild Yerushalayim so that Mashiach can come. So let me share with you some other sources that seem to imply this, and then we could try to put together exactly how this is going to impact us a little bit. First of all is the Siddur, which you're all familiar with. The Siddur contains, at the heart of our davening, the Shemona Esrei. Even though Shemona Esrei means 18, there are really 19 blessings in the Shemona Esrei. I brought them for you in the box here in number 8. Now in the Shemona Esrei, as you're familiar, the first three blessings are the same, no matter when you daven the Shemona Esrei. Same three opening blessings. And on the weekday, we have blessings number 4 through 15. 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9 are personal requests for intellect, for da'as, for tshuva, repentance, forgiveness, for slicha, personal salvation, goel Yisrael, health and healing, refa'enu, and prosperity, barech aleinu. Those are your blessings of the Shemona Esrei, 4 through 9. And then we go to the other side, numbers 10 through 15, which are 6 communal requests that we make on behalf of the Jewish people. Tikav b'shofar gadol, sound the great shofar and gather up our exiles, which is blessing number 10. Followed by the restoration of justice, followed by removing the heretics from the world, following by al tzadikim, the restoring the righteousness and righteous people into their appropriate place, followed by bonei Yerushalayim, rebuilding of Jerusalem, followed by Davidic reign, es tzemach David avdecha, the sprouting forth of Mashiach of the Davidic reign. That's the order. First 6 personal, moving into the 6 communal. Now, you might say, well, what's the idea with the order? Let's take the 6 back, the 6 communal. Is there any order here? Is it significant that we start with the ingathering of the exiles and we end with Mashiach? Was that just chosen? Did it fit well? Did it rhyme? Why was that chosen? Well, the Gemara asks that question. What's with the order? And the Gemara Megillah says, number 9, why did Chazal, the sages, see fit to say the blessing of the ingathering of exiles, number 10, which is the first on our communal list, following the blessing of prosperity? Right after we each give our personal blessing for prosperity, we move from that into ingathering of exiles. Asks the Gemara why. Answers the Gemara, because there's a verse, and we're going to get back to this verse at the end of the class. You mountains of Israel, sprout forth your branches and give forth your fruit to my people Israel, for they are close to returning. The Navi prophesies when the land will sprout forth, when the branches will give its produce. God says to the mountains, give forth your produce. My children are close to coming. So we give a blessing for prosperity, and then right after the blessing of prosperity, We go to the ingathering of the exiles, because that's what the Navi says. The prophet says, after the land begins to sprout, you know that my children are near, they're almost back. And then what happens after that? The next line of the Gemara says, once the exiles have been assembled, judgment will be visited on the wicked, which is blessing number 11. We go straight from the ingathering of the exiles to the restoration of justice. Once judgment has been visited upon the wicked, blessing number 11, then transgressors will cease to exist and the presumptuous sinners included with them. Blessing number 12. So this is the progression. You're following it in your chart. We go from the gathering of the exiles. That will restore justice. That will remove the heretics. When everybody's removed, the righteous will take their place in the world. And where will the horn of the righteous be exalted? In Jerusalem. The next blessing. Blessing number 14. And once Jerusalem is built, the kingdom of David will come, and that is our blessing of the Mashiach, Es Tzemach David Avdecha. So three times a day in our Shemona Esrei, we basically say what I was shocked to find out last year on a plane on the way to Eretz Yisrael, and we say this three times every day. We start with the ingathering of the exiles, and it begins the process following the prosperity. Then we ingather all of the exiles, and then we go through a process of restoring justice, removing the heretics, placing the righteous on the pedestal that they should be, and then rebuilding Jerusalem and establishing Mashiach as the Davidic rule in the land of Israel. Very interesting. Let's continue. Rashi says the following idea. This is a pasuk in Tehillim, in source number 10. The end of Perek Samach Tes 69, for God will save Zion and build the cities of Yehuda. So the Navi describes that the land will be rebuilt, and they will dwell there and possess it, and the land, the people will come into the land and possess it. And the offspring of his servants will inherit it, and those who love his name will dwell in it. A beautiful verse of Psalms, that the land will be rebuilt, the Jews will return, possess it, and inherit it. And then the next chapter begins for the conductor by David as a remembrance. And Rashi quotes that we go from one chapter describing the return of the exiles and settling of the land right into a psalm for the conductor by David as a remembrance. And Rashi says that last line is actually a prayer, because the Medrash compares this to a king who became angry at his flock. And what does a king do who becomes angry in his flock? He destroys its pen and banishes the sheep and the shepherd from his presence. And then the Medrash says, after a while, the king felt bad for his flock. So he took them back, and he rebuilt the pen and placed all of his sheep back in its newly rebuilt pen. And then the shepherd complained and said, but what about me? What about me? You took all of your I was just a hired hand, and you missed your flock and you rebuilt it, but you took them all back, you built the pen, you took in the sheep, I'm still on the outside. So too here, says the Medrash. The David HaMelech writes in Tehillim, God is going to bring back his children, they're going to settle the land, they'll inherit it. And for David, the conductor, a remembrance. It's a tefillah. What about, bring back the Davidic dynasty also. You took back all your children. You rebuilt their cities. Yerushalayim has been rebuilt. But what about me, the king, through my Messiah, through the Mashiach who's going to serve as that king? What about him? But what's clear in the way the Chazal are telling us, what's the order? What's the progression here? It's clear that the Jews are going back, rebuilding the cities, inheriting the land, and then the king says, but these are my people, and I'm still on the outside, and he'll then be brought in to rule over them. The Ramban, I'll give you one more. The Ramban says a similar thing, and it's commentary to Shir HaShirim. The Pasuk in Yishayo says that the Lord God who gathers the dispersed of Israel says, I will gather others to him besides those already gathered to him. Very interesting Pasuk in Yishayo. Two gatherings. I will gather those besides those already gathered. Says the Ramban, God will gather many, but not all, of the dispersed Jews at the outset of the redemption. And then after the wars of Gog and Magog, there will be a second in gathering, as it says, I will gather others to him besides those already gathered to him. Which would put us where? Right, where are we now? You look at these sources. Now again, we're looking in hindsight. I would never have done this 150 years ago and told you how it was going to happen. I'm just saying, I'm looking and saying, well, what's happened? Well, we have 6 million Jews living in the land of Israel right now. We have a major war that we're waiting for, meaning I don't mean even like with Iran. I mean, the sages have told us there will be a major war which takes place, known as Gog and Magog, which will take place before the advent of Mashiach, at which point the rest of the Jews come home.
Well, that's interesting, because I'm looking out at the world today and seeing I got almost half of the world's Jewish population in Israel. I got world-threatening world wars all over the place. Countries trying to create a world war, getting pretty close to it, and the rest of the Jews waiting on the outside. Now, the Ramban wrote this in the 1200s. So that's how it was going to happen. That was the process. I leave that as, at this point, we'll just leave that at that because we can't make any predictions. But what's of note is, if we're in the process, and it seems like there's good reason to assume we are, where was the call of the great shofar? Of the ingathering? Did we miss it? How did this just it just sort of happened? I mean, it was a miraculous event 65 years ago, but it just sort of took place. Like, we have all of these Jews living there now. Under our noses, in the last 65 years, 5.5 million Jews returned home. 5.5 million in 65 years. It's mind-boggling. There were about 600,000 Jews living in the land of Israel in 1948, and there are today over 6 million. In 65 years. Where did they come from? Everywhere. Except for America. We have probably the smallest rate of Aliyah out of the world, which is because we're still pretty safe. Everywhere else in the world, when troubles come, they all go. So, just putting that out there, for whatever that's worth. But where are we now? Where are we? How did this work? We have this process beginning. Is it happening now? Is it not happening now? I can't say anything. I'm just telling you what some of the sources have said, the way that it's going to look like, and what actually looks like, what is actually going on today. So let's go to a Gemara in Sanhedrin, which I think we'll find a fascinating Gemara, and will shed a lot of light on that which is taking place. It begins in source number 12. There's a contradiction in a pasuk in Yeshayahu. Exactly, and this is one of the primary sources of the procedure as to the way Mashiach is going to look. The verses in Yeshayahu in source number 12, it's a series of three verses. They're beautiful verses describing the time of when, of the Messianic era, your sun shall no longer set, neither shall your moon be gathered in, for the Lord shall be to you for an everlasting light, and the days of your mourning shall be completed. It will be a time of light. There will be no more mourning, no more pain and suffering and sadness. Your people, all of them righteous, shall inherit the land forever. A sign of my planting, the work of my hands, in which I will glorify. The people will return. The smallest shall become 1,000, and the least a mighty nation. I am the Lord. And then the Navi concludes, in its time, I will hasten it. That's a tricky phrase. In its time, I will hasten it. What does it mean that in its time, it will be hastened? If it's in its time, then it's at its right time. Well, how do you hasten something in its right time? I don't want to take any questions, just sorry, continue the story. So the Radak, one of the classic commentators on the Navi, understands that to mean when its time arrives, when the time for Mashiach comes, I will complete it hastily. Analogous to the Exodus from Egypt. They waited and waited and waited, 210 years, and then when it came time, it was swift and everybody was out. So the Radak understands that's what's going to happen. That's what it means. In its time, I will hasten it. When the time comes, and it's time to leave, and Mashiach does come, and the rest of us leave, it's going to be very, very quick. That's how the Radak understands this verse on the simple meaning of the text. The Gemara does something else entirely with this verse. The Gemara says as follows. The Gemara in the bottom of your page, in number 14, Rabbi Alexandri brings a contradiction, this contradiction that Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi noted. And he notes it as follows. On the one hand, it says, in its time. Now, if the redemption is going to take place in its time, that would seem to imply that it's going to happen at its preordained time, like it or not, whenever it's scheduled to happen, that's when it's going to be. Yet, on the other hand, it says, I will hasten it. So if you tell me that I will hasten it, that implies it's going to come before its time. So the Gemara asks, which one is it? Is the Mashiach going to come at its time? And that there's nothing we can do about it? When it's supposed to come is when it's going to come? Or can it be hastened? And the Gemara answers, if the Jews are deserving, if they merit it, If they're appropriately in their actions and behavior, then it will be hastened and it will come quickly. And if they do not merit it, then it will be in its time. There's a deadline, like it or not, deserve it or not, earn it or not, there is a deadline. When that deadline hits, Mashiach is coming. But if we merit it, if we earn it, and we deserve it, then it will be hastened and it will happen quickly, before its time. The next piece of Gemara. Similar contradiction. On the one hand, same two people, Rabbi Alexandri bringing a contradiction noted by Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi. Noted the following contradiction. On the one hand, it's written, "And behold, with the clouds of heaven, one like a man came." Implying that the way that the Mashiach is going to come is going to be riding the clouds of heaven. Now, we all know you can't really ride a cloud on a cloud, which implies it's going to be a miraculous time. That the Mashiach is going to come as if riding on a cloud of heaven. That's one verse which describes the arrival of the Mashiach. Yet there's another verse which says, on the other hand, a humble man riding on a donkey. Which implies that the Mashiach is going to come in a much more sluggish or mundane way. Riding on a donkey doesn't quite compare to riding on your cloud. Says the Gemara, which one is it? Does he ride on a cloud, or does he come in riding on a donkey? Answers the Gemara, not a contradiction. If the Jews are deserving, Mashiach will arrive with the clouds of heaven. If they are not deserving, he will arrive riding on a donkey. Now, we now have two statements from the Gemara. If we deserve it, if we merit it, Mashiach will come A, early, and B, riding a cloud of heaven. If we do not merit it, and we are not deserving, and the deadline just comes, he will then come, at its time, riding a donkey. What does it mean, riding a donkey? Rashi suggests, it's on your sheets, sluggishly, slowly. It's not going to be that quick. It's all of a sudden going to happen. It's going to happen slowly. It's going to happen over time. It's going to go in stages, step by step by step, so that all of a sudden he's going to be here, and you're going to say, how did that happen? Say, oh, well, all of these things have been going on for all of these years, slowly, slowly building, and before you knew it, it was here. But it's not going to happen where in a snap, all of a sudden, Mashiach shows up. The Or HaChaim, one of the classic commentators, he's printed in all of your standard Chumashim, has the following approach to add to what Rashi says, as far as understanding. What does it mean? If we merit it, then it's early, and it's on a cloud. But if we don't merit it, then it's on time, and it's a donkey. Says the Or HaChaim, it is in number 15. If the redemption will occur as a result of the merit of the Jewish people, as the Gemara says that we just quoted, then the Redeemer will be redeemed, revealed miraculously with divine, wondrous signs as it's described in the Zohar. If you read the Zohar, the description of Mashiach is miraculous. It's things that we've never seen before, heard of before. It's an amazing time period. Says the Or HaChaim, that's right. If you merit him, and he comes early, before the predestined time, it'll be riding on a cloud. It'll be riding a cloud of heaven. The Or HaChaim is basing himself, let me take one step back, he's writing in Chumash, he's writing on a pasuk in Parshas Balak. Parshas Balak, if you recall, has the prophet, the non-Jewish prophet Bilam, who attempts to curse the Jewish people and instead gives them a series of blessings. Most of his blessings are very cryptic. One of those blessings is quoted here at the top of number 15. I shall see him, but not now. I shall look at him, but it is not near. We're not going to get into that. The commentators understand that to be references to the Messianic time. We'll leave that aside for now. A star has issued from Jacob, and a scepter bearer has risen from Israel. On the one hand, he's described as a star arising from Yaakov, and on the other hand, as a king, a scepter bearer. A star or a king, says the Or HaChaim. Well, you know what this pasuk is hinting at? There are two types of redemption. If you merit it, the Jewish people are worthy and deserving, it's going to happen early, and it's going to be miraculous. And as hinted on the words, it'll be like a star riding on a cloud of heaven. And everything about it will be miraculous.
You'll know when he comes because the whole thing is going to take 10 minutes. Everyone's going to end up in Israel. How is that going to happen? I have no idea. But it's miraculous time. He's going to be riding on a cloud of heaven. A star will be born out of Jacob. But, says the Or HaChaim, if you do not merit it, if you're on the back half of that Gemara, not that I will hasten it, but you're on the side of in its time, because you weren't worthy, you didn't deserve it, you didn't merit it, but the time came, so I have to bring him. So then I bring him in a very different way. And the way the Or HaChaim describes it, if they are unworthy, it will take place in a different manner, like the poor man riding the donkey. This is hinted at with the words, a scepter bearer has risen, meaning a king will arise in the regular ways of the world through natural means. Or Chaim is writing several hundred years ago saying, if you blow it, if you don't merit to bring him early, and the time limit comes, he's going to come. It's going to be slow, and it's going to be natural. It is not going to be miraculous. Every step of the way will seem to fit like a king has arisen out of Israel. It's not a star. It's not riding a cloud of heaven. It's a guy, a poor man, riding on a donkey. Slowly. Sluggishly. Making his way with natural means at his disposal to create a kingdom, to create a country, to create a state. In ways that you would look at every single step along the way and say, oh, I mean, that's not miraculous, that's normal, and that's normal, and that's normal. Really, if you look at what's going with it, it's not normal, but it is normal. It's not normal. It's normal means, but it's crazy that it's happening all so quickly together. But it, in a way, it's, that's how he, several hundred years ago, that's what's going to happen if you hit your time limit. Now, I'm sure all of you are familiar with another statement that the sages make, that there's a 6,000-year time limit, and we get to, that's when Mashiach is going to come, the 6,000 years, the 6 days of creation. By the time you get to Shabbos, he's coming, and we always take in Shabbos a little bit early, so we're right at the end, 5773, the last 250 years. It's already that crazy time for Erev Shabbos, no matter when Shabbos starts, that last 15, 20 minutes is always nuts. We're in that period. Right at the end. But we miss all of our chances. We apparently didn't earn it, didn't deserve it, and didn't merit it early, because we're at the end. And how does it happen when it's at the end? It's not on a cloud of heaven. It's a man riding a donkey. It's sluggish and it's slow and it's natural. It just happens. And half the people are going to go back. Then there's going to be a big war. And another half is going to happen. Now, I'm going to take a step back again. I'm not predicting what's going to happen because I don't know. I'm only looking back at what has happened, saying what has happened fits with what has been said hundreds of years ago would happen. Now, I'm also picking and choosing because there are tons of statements about it, and I didn't tell you all of those because they may not be so obvious as far as connecting. So the whole discussion is, nothing is clear about it, and certainly nothing is clear about it moving forward. But it's of note to share that there are several significant commentaries from hundreds of years ago describing the process as we have described it now, which fits very well with, as we would say, a very natural, slow-moving process to reestablish a kingdom of the Sion of David in the land of Israel. After the Jews have returned, Yerushalayim has been rebuilt, setting the stage for Mashiach to come. Let me go back. Let's take one last piece. There's an oft-quoted Gemara in Maseches Ksuvos. The Gemara here is one of the most famous pieces of Gemara in regards to the Mashiach, because it has really been the source over the last 65 years at the heart of the biggest theological differences amongst the Jewish people. And that's what's known as the Three Oaths. The Talmud records that when God banished the Jewish people from the land of Israel, He made them take three oaths as to, or really two to the Jews and one to the non-Jews of the world, as to how they would behave to the Jews while the Jews were in exile. We'll read the Gemara, we'll talk a little bit about it. This is an entire class into itself, and we're not going to go through it in depth. But the Gemara says as follows, what or why are these three oaths that were taken? Number one, source number 16, that Israel should not storm the wall. That's the language of the Gemara. The Jewish people may not storm the wall is understood most commonly to mean not return in mass with force to the land of Israel. The language of the Gemara is storming the wall, and most overwhelming number of the commentators understand that to mean not forcing your way in mass back to the land of Israel. Two, the second oath that the Holy One adjured Israel not to rebel against the nations of the world. That while you're in exile and while you're living in lands owned by other people, you are a visitor in their land and you may not rebel against them. And number three was an oath against the nation, to the nations of the world, that they would not oppress the Jewish people too much. A little bit, yes. And that's not a joke. In other words, the Gemara says that there needs to be the oppression, because if we wouldn't have oppression, we might actually like it in the exile. And we might actually forget that we're in exile. And our children that are born in exile might think that this is normal. And that's not normal. We are not supposed to be here, and none of us should be here, and we need to remember that, so that the nations of the world will regularly remind us of that. And that's what's taking place. And if you follow anything in Jewish world history, the pattern is pretty much the same. We get to a place, we're welcomed, we settle in, and as soon as things seem to be pretty good and we get really comfortable, that's usually when things turn around. That's the Gemara, the three oaths. Now this came to a head. These three oaths have been in existence since the time of the Talmud. And the Jews had never really had much reason to deal with it, and they never stormed the land of Israel in mass. It wasn't an option for most of Jewish history. And in the early 1900s, with the advent of the Zionist movement, where there were, this was before 1948, but the strong movement to resettle the land, to bring masses of Jews back, this Gemara, this piece, became a central theological point amongst the different camps within Judaism. How to deal with this Gemara. What do we deal with the fact that Gemara says we took an oath not to storm our way back in? We also took an oath not to rebel, and the nations of the world took an oath not to oppress us too much. So there were three major camps as to how to deal with this. On the one side was the camp led by the Satmar Hasidim and others, who view this until today, that this is a binding statement. I'm going to give you like a tidbit. There are books written about this passage of the Talmud and various ways of interpreting. You can even see, I even looked it up, you can go to Wikipedia, and they have a long article, very well written, that goes through all the different approaches that have been quoted. It's fascinating what you could find on the internet. But there are entire books written on this passage, and the various approaches within different camps of Judaism, how to deal with it, what to deal with it, because the Ramban, for example, holds that it's a mitzvah for every Jew to settle the land. So if each and every one of us has a mitzvah to settle the land, how do you deal with the fact that we took an oath not to? So it's a theological issue. Does the Gemara mean this as a halacha, or just it's a gadda, it's a piece of passage in the Talmud? We didn't really take an oath, it just means to give us an idea. There are so many different ways of dealing with this. We're not, just briefly, very, very briefly. So the one approach on the one extreme, so the Satmar Hasidim, the Turi Karta, you still find elements of this today that holds the Gemara is binding as a law that a Jew is prohibited from being in the land of Israel, not from being there, from having any form of control over the land of Israel, because we took an oath to wait until God brings us back, and we will not return there on our own. As recently, it could be even more recently, but I know that in 1996, they took out an ad in the New York Times. Just to give you a sense of the approach that you know, these are the people who like are protesting, you know, at AIPAC. The Jews they're the Hasidim that you see in the news, always on the sides of the Palestinians, because they believe that they're being religiously observant. The ad in the New York Times reads as follows: Torah Jewry sees its exile from the Holy Land as a result of a divine decree based upon the Talmud, which we read, which prohibit the Jewish people to travel en masse to the Holy Land. We're prohibited from doing so, to rebel against other nations, or in any way to seek to hasten the messianic process by worldly means. This is this one approach, it's an extreme approach, but it exists. We're prohibited from doing so. The land was given to us according to God's will, and when our sins accumulated, we were exiled from it. This exile is in essence a spiritual state that cannot be remedied by any temporal means, until God chooses to end history as we know it by redeeming us through miraculous acts. We are commanded by Him to live as cooperative, law-abiding, and patriotic citizens in the countries of our residence. Accordingly, the Jewish people have no claim to the Holy Land at present, no rights to it, to conquer it, or to rule over it. Those are Jews putting that in the New York Times, expressing the opinion that says we are prohibited from doing so, and doing so is a violation of Jewish law, and therefore religiously bound to protest against any Jewish government in the land of Israel. That's one approach. That's an extreme. I imagine any of you who are sitting here today probably do not adhere to that, nor does the majority of the Jewish world, but it exists. There were approaches on the other side, primarily led by Rabbi Cook, the chief rabbi of Eretz Yisrael in the early 1900s, who believed that what was taking place with the Zionist movement was redemptive in nature. It was part of the redemptive process and should be looked at accordingly. That every step of the way was a part of the redemption, should be spoken about it as such and viewed as such. So that it was an extreme to the other. Not just that it's prohibited, but that we're actually watching the redemption happen. And the majority of Jews viewed it just as a positive. The Jews are coming home. I don't know if it's redemption, it's not redemption. It's just a good thing to have a place to go. It's a good thing to return home. Something in the middle. Not necessarily part of the redemptive process. I don't know. I can't say. It's not forbidden. And deal with it as such. How do we deal with the oath? There have been many approaches how to deal with the oath, ranging from the UN is the body that gave us permission to go back. So it's not that we're rebelling against the nations of the world and storming the wall. We were given permission, ranging from, well, listen, we just came out of the Holocaust. The nations of the world took an oath not to oppress us too much. If they don't abide by their oath, then we don't have to abide by our oath. Versus the fact that it was so miraculous in nature that it happened, that it was indeed a sign of the miraculous redemption at hand, to approaches that the Gemara, one of the things the Gemara says will happen in the times of the Messiah is that chutzpah will be rampant. There'll just be chutzpah everywhere. People will be chutzpahdik. I know it's impossible to imagine. The Gemara says that's going to be a sign of the coming of the Mashiach. So one of the commentators, Reb Tzadok HaKohen, writes, you're right, we took an oath not to, but the Gemara says we're going to be chutzpahdik when Mashiach comes. And look, the Zionists are being chutzpahdik and it's working. That's another one. There are numerous approaches to deal with the Gemara. We're not going to spend it. We have this. There's such an oath. Shlomo Tachtel, if I have the name right, was a Hasidish Rebbe, wrote a brilliant book called Eim Habanim Semecha. He died in 1943 in the war. He was killed right towards the end of the war in a camp. And he was a Hasidish Rebbe who lived his whole life on the side of the first approach that I quoted, from the Satmar Hasidim, anti-Zionist, anti the return of the land, it's a bad thing for the Jewish people. And his experience in the war changed him. And he actually totally flipped, this is before the state, in 43, he died in 43, totally switched and saw that it was because the Jews did not return to the land was the cause of all of the problems of the war, and the solution to the Jewish problem was returning home. And in hiding in a basement without access to a single sefer, he wrote a brilliant sefer in which he quotes hundreds of sources. And he writes all the time. I'm not quoting it exactly because I don't have it in front of me. And in the footnotes that they've since printed, they changed, you know, a couple of words that he didn't have right because he didn't have the books in front of him. In which he brings source after source after source to show that at this stage in history, the time is right to return. And he brings what we just discussed as a response to the Satmar Hasidim's approach, which he wrote in the ads that they took, that it's forbidden from going. And he writes, but the Gemara says that if we don't merit it, and we're at the end of the line, it's going to happen sluggish, and it's going to happen naturally. It's not going to happen in miraculous ways. It might have, but not at the end. Then it's just through natural means. And therefore, we are obligated to use natural means to begin the resettlement of the land, to begin developing it, to begin returning home, because it's going to go in stages. There's going to be a return, there's going to be a war, there's going to be a second return. And the way to make that happen is to begin the process by getting Jews home. And when Jews return home, that's actually the beginning of the process. Not all the Jews will return home at first. There will be a segment, a chunk that do, and that's going to begin the process as we daven for. They'll return home, there'll be justice, there'll be the removal of the heretics, Yerushalayim will be rebuilt, and then we'll have the coming of the Mashiach and the returning of the rest of us. What does that mean for all of us? I leave you with a thought. One of the statements the Gemara makes
I have it on number 17. Amongst all of the statements of when Mashiach is coming and what the time frame will look like is as follows. Rabbi Abba says, there is no clearer indication of the end than this. And there's a verse that we quoted earlier tonight. You, the mountains of Israel, shall shoot forth your branches and bear your fruit for my people Israel, for they are soon to come. The pasuk in Yechezkel, Ezekiel, the prophet, describes that Hashem says to the land, give forth your fruit. And when that happens, the people are close to coming. That was in the blessings we say in Shemoneh Esrei. The end of the six personal brachas are for prosperity, and then we go right to the ingathering. The Jewish people have a unique relationship with the land, unlike any other land in the world. And that is, the Torah says explicitly, when I exile you, the land will cease to give forth its produce. The land that flows with milk and honey will do so when you are on it. But when you are not on it, the Torah describes it will be a barren wasteland. It will not give forth its fruit. And throughout the centuries, historians who have come have written about the wasteland that is the land of Palestine. Mark Twain has a well-known passage from his book Innocents Abroad, in which he writes in his visit in 1867, Palestine sits in sackcloth and ashes. Over it broods the spell of a curse that has withered its fields and fettered its energies. Palestine is desolate and unlovely. It is sacred only to poetry and tradition, but it's a dreamland, because in reality there's nothing here, he writes. Hardly a tree or a shrub anywhere. Even the olive and the cactus, fast friends of a worthless soil, had almost deserted the country. Many others have written similarly about a land that's barren, a land that's not producing. When you go there today and you see the miracle of a desert in bloom, you see green everywhere, you see produce, you see exporting of produce, that every ounce of land is being cultivated. When we went to Israel, I was blown away. We went last year on our Tanakh tour, we went to the Galil, and we went to a land that the Jews had conquered in the 67 day wars up in the Galil, and they had taken a swampland which was infested with malaria in 1967. It was nothing. And they're now producing world-class wine from a winery. So they didn't just actually clear out the malaria. In 30, 40 years, cleared it out, built up vineyards, produced wineries, and are now producing and exporting throughout the world these world-class wines. It doesn't make any sense. How is it possible? All that's going on. That sign, as the Gemara says, is the surest sign of the coming of the Messiah. Because Yechezkel Hanavi says, when God says to the land, give forth your produce, for my children are near, they're coming back. And the land is bursting, it's alive with energy. That is one of the sure, when you look at what's taking place today, in terms of all the things that we started with, the fact that there are 6 million people who have returned, the fact that there's a culture, there's an economy, there's its own currency, there's a stock market, agriculture, technology, the language, the army, you name it, it's there. And it's hard not to see a fulfillment of what has been described from hundreds of years prior, as the stages leading up to it. What will be in the future again, I have no idea. I know what's going to happen, I just don't know how or when. But what's going to happen, we have plenty of sources for. How or when it's going to look like, we don't know. I conclude with the Rambam's words in the Laws of Kings, your final source. The main thing to remember is that neither the order of the occurrence of these events or their precise detail are among the fundamental principles of our faith. That doesn't matter. Everything we discuss tonight doesn't make a single difference. Whether it does happen this way, or it doesn't happen this way, or if somebody listens to this recording 10 years ago from now and says, it's all wrong, it didn't happen like that at all, it looked like it was going this way, maybe, I don't know. It's possible. It doesn't matter. The fundamentals of our faith is that it will happen. That Mashiach is coming, that we yearn and wait for the return home, not just so that we should be home, but that Hashem's presence should be open, it should be revealed, the world should be brought back to the place that it's supposed to be with Hashem's presence, is recognized as truth, the Torah is observed amongst the Jewish people and recognizes truth, and we yearn for that redemption. That's what's significant, says the Rambam. So yeah, we have all these sources that we're looking for, we look backwards, and we never look forward in history, we can't look forward to the future, what's going to be, we can look to the past.
Looking where we are now, in 2013, what's taken place over the last 65 years, it's hard to say we're not in the midst of a process. It's just hard to say that there are 6 million Jews living in the land of Israel. There's more Jews that lived there than the time of the Second Temple. Torah has returned. It's the center. World Torah Judaism is now in Israel. First time since the Second Temple period. It's been either in Europe or in Babylonia. It's never been in Israel in the way that it is now. It's just, look what's going on. We went to, one last little anecdote, and I'll conclude with that. On our tour, we spent a night up in the north, near the Kinneret, in a hotel. We were there on a Sunday night. Monday morning we're Shachris. We come to Davin Monday morning. And the way that it worked, I pointed this out to our tour guide who noticed the same thing. The Balkorei was an Israeli fellow. I don't know, Bati Lumi, I guess you'd call him. And the guy who got Rishon was some Yemenite Jew. The guy who got Sheni was a Hasidish Yid. And the guy who got Shlishi was a Sephardi Jew. And you looked at the four people who were involved during the Torah reading, and nobody pronounced the word similar to anybody else. They all sounded completely different, because they came from four different parts of the world. And you look at them and say, we're watching the kibbutz golios. We're watching the ingathering of the exiles. It's happening. So when I pointed this out to the guide, I said, do you see what happened in Shachris this morning? Wasn't that amazing? Like, from the four corners of the earth, they all ended up in our same little shul here in our hotel in the Kinneret. He said, when he takes guides, when they run into soldiers, and when he's with his groups, the Americans, and he's touring around the country, they see a group of soldiers. He says, he calls over his tour, he says, he has his four or five soldiers, he says, where are you guys from? And so they say all over the country where they're from. He says, where are your parents from? So half of the parents are Israeli born and half are foreigners. Where are your grandparents from? And the whole world. And now, two generations later, they're all Israeli buddies in the same unit in the army. They wouldn't know the difference. But you just go back two generations and you name it. They came from the four corners of the earth. So there are certain things that are happening that are hard to ignore. It's hard to ignore the significance of what's taking place, the excitement of what's taking place. Does that mean that we should all leave? I'm not saying anything. Does it mean we should be here next year? I don't know. We all yearn and wait and hope it'll be today, tomorrow. That's our responsibility. But I find fascinating and significant as we go through this to be aware of some of the things that our sages have told us will happen in the methods that it will. As the Rambam says, it doesn't matter if it happens this way or that way. It doesn't matter. It's not fundamental to our faith that it happens this way or that way. But to be inspired by what's taking place, that is my goal, and tonight, that we should walk out of here inspired to continue that yearning to see it happen, to know that that's our agenda, that's our goal, to return home to see the redemption, and b'mehir b'mehir Mashiach should come soon in our day, and take us back there as we shall. For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. He does not make money off the site, but he does need money in order to run the site. Those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.